Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I've met many of you, I believe. I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I'm delighted to welcome you all to our Independent Policy Forum program this evening. A number of you have been with us before. The Independent Policy Forum is a regular series of debates, lectures, seminars, and panel discussions that we hold here at the Independent Institute's Conference Center here in Oakland, California. As you know, our program tonight is entitled The Drug War on Trial, and we're delighted to have two distinguished judges to examine the war on drugs. As many of you know, the Institute regularly sponsors programs like this as part of our broader program in public policy. As an organization, we're actually an academic research institute, and we have many fellows at universities in the U.S. and around the world who are engaged in research for us on many social and economic issues, the results of which are published as books and our journal, The Independent Review. This is the current issue that just came in fact, today. And we get engaged in many conference and media projects like the one this evening. I want to particularly thank the Lindesmith Center Drug Policy Foundation for their kind assistance with this evening, and for those of you who are not familiar with them or are, there are some brochures up here in front entitled Join the New Anti-War Movement, which I strongly encourage everyone to do, and that will give you further information, and Marcia Rosenbaum and others from the center are with us tonight. I also want to thank the Robert Mondavi Winery for donating the excellent wine that we were able to enjoy this evening. For those of you who are new to the Institute, hopefully you received a packet when you registered. You'll find information about our programs and our publications and membership opportunities. And of course, if you don't join, you can't leave tonight, but we do hope that you will join with us. Also on our website, I want to point out independent.org. A little over a year ago, we held another event on the drug war and, featuring Alex Coburn and Jonathan Marshall and others, and that program is in a transcript and an audio file which you can access on the website. Our next event, which in your packet there is a green sheet about tonight's program on the back, or actually the bottom of the front page, you'll see information about two upcoming events. The very next event is going to be held on October 3rd. For those of you who are fed up with traffic congestion and the price of housing and so forth. In fact, many of our attendees, believe it or not, are still on 880, which is the parking lot tonight. The program is entitled Smarter Urban Growth, Markets or Bureaucracy. The two speakers will be Randall O'Toole, who's a senior economist at the Thoreau Institute. He's also visiting professor currently at the College of Natural Resources at the University of California, Berkeley. The other speaker is Daniel Klein, who's a professor of economics at Santa Clara University. Dr. O'Toole is the author of a new book called The Vanishing Automobile and Other Myths, and Dan Klein is co-author of a book called Curb Rights that came out from Brookings Institution Press about a year ago. And I guarantee this will be a very lively and provocative evening. For tonight, however, we are here to discuss a very serious and widespread problem or host of problems that have stemmed from America's war on drugs. Earlier last month, many of you may know, by a vote of 98-1, the U.S. Senate confirmed Arkansas Congressman Asa Hutchinson to become the appropriately titled czar of the $1.5 billion Drug Enforcement Administration. Incidentally, the Drug Enforcement Administration is only a small part of the federal government's involvement in the war on drugs. The only dissenting vote in this confirmation process was Minnesota Senator Mark Dayton, who stated that he disagreed strongly with Hutchinson's strong opposition to the legalization of medical marijuana. As a congressman, Hutchinson called for tougher penalties for drug users. He called for coerced abstinence for addicts and increased use of the military in overseas drug interdictions, such as what's happening in Colombia. In so doing, our new drug czar has called the federal war on drugs, quote, a great crusade, unquote. Meanwhile, on September 4th, just yesterday, in Vandalia, Michigan, an FBI agent shot and killed Grover Crossland, whose campground, called the Rainbow Farm, was known for its advocacy of marijuana use. The campground was the target of civil asset forfeiture proceedings by police after Crossland had been arrested for possession of marijuana and a firearm. Crossland had then taken the step to set fire to the buildings on his property, virtually all of which had burned to the ground, distressing the police, needless to say. Less than 12 hours later, Crossland's roommate, Roland Rome, was also fatally shot by an FBI agent. According to the Rainbow Farms website, Crossland had bought the property 15 years ago with the idea of supporting, quote, the medical, spiritual, and responsible recreational use of marijuana for a more sane and compassionate America, unquote. In response to this incident, Vandalia Mayor Sandra Mose Usery said she knew Crossland well, quote, he believes he should be able to do what he wants on his own property, unquote. Since 1968, the Great Crusade by governments in the U.S. has spent increasing amounts of money. Our two speakers here know about this very well in their work and otherwise. The estimates today are that about $40 billion per year currently is being spent to stop drug use. Three-fourths of such federal spending, three-fourths of the federal component of that spending, goes to police, prisons, border patrols, interdiction efforts. And yet after 30 years, there are no fewer addicts, but a lot more people in prison. For example, from 1973 to 1983, the number of state and federal prisoners in the U.S. doubled to over 660,000, and then doubled again in 1993 to 1.4 million. By 1998, this number had risen to 1.8 million, and although crime has been decreasing in recent years, the number of drug arrests continues to grow. Today, the U.S. has the highest incarceration rate of any country in the world, except Russia. In California alone, with only one-tenth the population of the combined countries of France, Great Britain, Germany, Japan, Singapore, and the Netherlands, there are more people incarcerated than all those countries combined. And the U.S., with less than 5% of the world population, has 25% of the world's prisoners. I could go on and on, but there's much more that I think our speakers could better address than just these statistics that I'm mentioning tonight. Needless to say, the problem is significant. One other little tidbit I'll throw out is there's different numbers. One number I think is particularly striking. Although African Americans make up only 13% of the U.S. population, they make up 70% of all drug incarcerations. In the year 2001, a record 74% of Americans say that they believe the drug war is failing. Well, that's a good sign, and hopefully that trend will continue. To explore our interest in this serious problem, we are very honored to have two distinguished legal experts with us tonight. The first is the author of a book from Temple University Press, which I strongly urge everyone to get. It's called Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed and What We Can Do About It. It's not the best cover in the world, but perhaps that's one of the advantages of the book. It's a very stark, striking, powerful book. The author of that book is Judge James P. Gray. He was appointed judge to the Santa Ana Municipal Court in 1993 and then to the Superior Court in 1989. Judge Gray is also adjunct professor at Chapman University. He received his undergraduate degree from UCLA and his JD from USC. Judge Gray has served in the Peace Corps. He's been a staff judge advocate for the U.S. Navy and as a federal prosecutor for the U.S. Attorney in Los Angeles. He's also co-founder of the Association of Former U.S. Attorneys and has been awarded Judge of the Year from both the Business Litigation Section of the Orange County Bar and the Orange County Constitutional Rights Foundation. He has also received the Drug Policy Foundation's Justice Gerald LaDain Award. He's a member of many state and county legal committees, advisory boards, and we're very lucky to have him with us. I'm very pleased to introduce Judge James Gray.
Well, thank you all. David, thank you for that. It's a pleasure to be able to be with you. There is a trap that we can all fall into, because I'll bet you that I'm probably not going to convince anyone here tonight, because you probably are already convinced of this subject. And the trap is that we sit around and we talk about how smart we are and how we have all of the answers, and then we go off on about our business. And we have to do better, because it is our government. This is a great country we're in, and it is a pretty good government too. But we in a democracy get the government that we deserve, and I'm afraid that I have to stand here tonight and share with you my thought that we're not doing a particularly good job of that. And one of the biggest reasons, in fact, the most critical issue that we in our great country today are facing, is the issue of drug policy. What should we do instead of what we're doing now? Because I can tell you that our present drug policy is the worst that we could ever come up with. I could take the front of this room, you're an intelligent looking group, and give you the task to stay with each other for the next week and design a worse drug policy than we have in our country, and you could not do it. And that's a problem. You know, I've been talking about this since April the 8th of 1992. So that's, what, 9 years and something. I forecast with my crystal ball, and I had all the answers. I held a press conference, an unusual thing to do for a sitting judge. But I held a press conference and said the obvious, namely what we're doing in our drug policy is not working. And then I forecast, saying that by the year 2000, folks, we're going to have a materially different drug policy in our country. Well, I was in error. I'm shocked, because it's so obvious to me. I feel like going up to people and shaking them, just saying, look, open your eyes. See what we're doing. See what our options are. Let's do something better. And people still just don't get it. However, I'm in good company, because back in the mid-1980s, the United States Congress passed a resolution by a resounding number saying that we in the United States of America will be drug-free by the year 1994. So their crystal ball is a little more cloudy than mine. So I have gone around talking. I talk with any group that I can, consistent with getting my job done. And the introduction that you just heard from David was laudatory, and thank you. It was a little bit too long. But it's a lot better than one I can remember very strongly, which was quite a bit shorter and was on the nature of, I know you all want to hear the latest dope from the courthouse, so here's Judge Gray. But we're making progress as we go. Let me ask you good folks 5 questions. I'll bet I know the answer, but let me ask them anyway. How many of you people as taxpayers care about how your tax money is spent? If you do, we must repeal drug prohibition, because we are squandering our resources badly. I was in Orange County a year ago July, when then drug czar, now retired, thankfully, McCaffrey was in business. And he was touting, bragging, that his budget, the Office of National Drug Control Policy, his budget alone was increased from $17.8 billion the year before to $19.2 billion that year. That is an awful lot of money. Does anyone have any concept of how much money that is, just for that one Office of National Drug Control Policy? You know that United Airlines had for a long time a bid to purchase U.S. Air. It's simply fallen. It's since then fallen apart. Do you know how much that was for? $4.6 billion. That means that McCaffrey and his budget alone could have purchased 4 major airlines every year and had something on the order of $800 million left over. That's how much money we're throwing around here. Politicians in Washington really do understand this issue. They really do understand that the war on drugs is not winnable, but it's eminently fundable, and they love to spend money. They're addicted to spending money, and it's up to us as taxpayers, voters, and citizens to say no. So if you care about how your drug money or how your money in government is spent, I didn't say that. You know, come on, folks. Fortunately, there's no court reporter here tonight. I was in voir dire, you know, just talking to jury, trying to get a jury just yesterday morning, and I was talking about drinking a Chevrolet. So if I can do that, you know, I can do anything. But if we care about how our government money is spent, the answer is what? Repeal drug prohibition. Let me ask you my second question. How many of you care about our civil liberties in our country, the Bill of Rights and all of those protections? We must care about these. If I were to rewrite my book, because I have a chapter talking about the erosion of civil liberties in our country because of drug cases, all before the United States Supreme Court. If I were to rewrite that chapter, the subheading would be, Where's Paul Revere? Why aren't we spreading this alarm that we are giving away our civil liberties to the intrusions of government, the Fourth Amendment, you know, with search and seizure, and the Fifth Amendment, self-incrimination. It goes on and on. This is really disturbing to me. So if you care about your civil liberties, the answer is what? Repeal drug prohibition, because that is responsible for more loss of civil liberties in the United States of America than anything in the history of our country. How many people would like to decrease the availability of these sometimes dangerous and sometimes addicting drugs to our children? Isn't that what this is all about? Isn't that what drug policy is really meant to do? To try to reduce drug usage and availability to our children? If you want that to happen, the answer is what? Repeal drug prohibition. Ask your kids. Ask any of our underage young people, as I do. Can you get alcohol? Yeah, okay, I confess. I was under 21 for a while. I think you were too. And yes, we know we can get alcohol, but you've got to work at it. You've got to show some ingenuity, some effort, some thought, creativity even. It is easier for our young people to get methamphetamines, marijuana, cocaine, if they want them, than it is a six-pack of beer. Why? Why? Because the illegal, or the alcohol is regulated by the government, and the illegal drugs are controlled by the mob. And I would start to say, well, mob drug lords don't care if your 16-year-old daughter uses cocaine. But they do care. They want her to. They push it on her. And that is the problem that we are facing and exacerbating because of our present drug prohibition laws, isn't it? If we care about our children, the answer is repeal drug prohibition, isn't it? Another question, number four. We want to be able to control our own lives. We want to be able to make our own medical decisions and our own decisions as to what we will put into our bodies. You know, pretty much every evening, I will confess to you openly that I go home after work and I take a mind-altering, sometimes addicting drug. Namely, I have a glass of wine with dinner. Alcohol by far is a more dangerous drug than marijuana. I don't think you'll find anybody that disputes that question. But, that's okay. I don't know, I've never smoked marijuana. I don't want to either. But, you know, I don't think, okay, I don't think that I need alcohol treatment. I really don't think I do. So the answer is, make people accountable for their actions. Isn't that what the government should be doing? Holding people accountable for what they do. And of all people, I can say it in this group, of all people, Ronald Reagan stated it best. Ronald Reagan said, it is the purpose of government, among other things, to protect us from each other. And I think he's right. But he went on to say that where government goes astray is when we try to protect us from ourselves. Government has no business protecting us from ourselves. I wish he had followed his own comment with regard to the war on drugs. But he's right, isn't he? So if you want to bring back individual responsibility in our society, individual accountability, the answer is repeal drug prohibition. And finally, my question number five. There is such a thing. Look it up. as the Ninth Amendment to the United States Constitution and the Tenth Amendment to the United States Constitution. It's very unwidely read and discussed, but it's gaining a little bit of prominence in federal court, in the United States Supreme Court. What does it say? It says that except for certain specified powers in the federal government, the other powers are reserved for the states. We have an enormously arrogant and all-powerful federal government that is dictating to us what we will do with regard to drug policy. That power is misplaced. That power is appropriately brought back to local control. And of course, the best example of that is medical marijuana. You're mentioning Asa Hutchinson. I was actually on the O'Reilly Factor. That's a fun experience. But it was on that show, I've been on twice, but it was about 2 weeks ago, and Asa Hutchinson was on as well. He was the other guest. And I spoke to him via great monitors in the sky, telling him I was very disappointed that he was appointed and confirmed as the new head of the DEA. He sat there smiling away. He has the best smile you've ever seen. Didn't seem to faze him. But I asked him, I said, look, will you please commit to, as the head of the DEA, to allowing a medical doctor to make a decision as to the right medicine for his or her patients? And if medical marijuana is a medical decision, should that power not be redelegated from him as the head of the DEA, where it is now, as to whether this will be a Schedule 1, 2, 3, or whatever drug? Should it not be redelegated to the Surgeon General, who is a medical doctor? And he actually agreed. And boy, I hope he does that. And I tell you, I'm going to try to keep reminding him. And please, I want you to remind him of that as well. We can do that and should. But the real question here is, because we're all on the same side, we must make sure that our fellow citizens, voters, taxpayers, etc., understand this. We're all on the same side of this issue. We all want to decrease drug usage, harmful drug usage, the misery and the crime and the violence that go with all of this. That's what we want to do, and drug policy should take a firm stand at trying to decrease all of that harm. The answer, of course, and where we disagree is how best to accomplish that. We have options, but what we must do first is to legitimize the discussion. And if I've been able, with privilege, to sign any of your books tonight, and I'd love to sign whoever you would like, I will most of the time say on the inscription that we need good people like are here in this room to legitimize the discussion in this area. Because once we accomplish that, we will change our nation's drug policy, because it is so plain, so apparent that what we're doing is not working, that we will change it as soon as we allow the light of day to shine upon this issue. And what we really then need to do beyond that is to understand that we have options. Now, with great labor, I have in the book, and I'm pleased that you have at least access to this. I'll never make any money on it. That isn't the idea. I want people to be using the book as a tool, because the book, I think, offers two areas that are so far unused in this entire subject. One is, the subtitle of the book, as you'll notice, is A Judicial Indictment of the War on Drugs. And it's not just me. I cite at least 40 judges from around the country who give their experience, their thoughts, their discussions about what has happened in this area. And that is a way that we can legitimize this discussion as well. And of course, there are an awful lot more that are out there that either have commented or will in the future. But the second thing is the options, the possibilities. These are not untried. These are not experimental. There are things going on today, for example, in the country of Switzerland, that you should be aware of. And if you would, please, when you get the book, if you do, read about the medical maintenance programs of drugs in Switzerland going on today. Started in Liverpool, England, and I don't have time to go through it so much right now. But they are, going into the communities, in clinics, finding heavy using narcotics addicts, mostly heroin. That seems to be the problem in Switzerland. And they're bringing them, what? Closer to the medical professionals that can help them. And when they do that, they do what you or I would do. They try to get them into some drug treatment because these drugs are harming them medically, physically, other ways. And they're harming, of course, their families. So they try to get them into drug treatment. But for one reason or another, most people don't want to do it at this point. And so they give them another option. They will actually find out a maintenance dosage for the heroin of these people. That means that they can go to a particular clinic. They have access to pharmaceutical grade heroin, which at cost, which is, I mean, this stuff's dirt cheap to grow, manufacture, and come by, so that's not an issue. Easily $10 a day takes care of all of these people per person. And they will find a maintenance dosage, which means that they won't get any euphoria, they won't get a jolt or a high on it, but they also won't go through withdrawal. They're maintained at their present level. And you know what they have found out? They had an experimental program, a pilot program, that began in the middle 1990s. It was supposed to go for 3 years in seven cities in Switzerland doing this with their addicted people. The Minister of Health in Switzerland held a press conference after 1 year and said, you know, this program is so successful, we're not going to wait the full 3 years. We're going to expand it to 20 cities now because we have seen wonderful results. What have we found? They found that crime in the neighborhoods surrounding these clinics noticeably went down. Why would that be? Just because you're furnishing at cost heroin to some of these addicted people, why would that have an effect on crime? Well, that's not hard at all to figure. What do I as an addict do in order to support my habit? I'll burglarize your house, your car. I'll hit you over the head at the ATM when you take some money out, commit some form of check offenses. You know, the merchants in the neighborhoods surrounding the clinics, as I understand it, in some of these places, experienced a sevenfold decrease in shoplifting because these people were no longer involved in crime to support their habits. That's a good thing. And Switzerland agreed. The second thing he found out was that drug usage in the neighborhoods surrounding these clinics also was noticeably reduced. Well, why would that be, for heaven's sake? You know, these people are getting the heroin. They count in the equation. Why would drug usage go down? It went down noticeably. Why? Because what do I as an addict do now? Yes, I burglarize your house and prostitute and the rest, but I also get larger amounts of drugs and push it on you, your neighbors, and your children in order to support my habit. But if these people are arrested, they're off the program, and they no longer have to do that because they're getting access to these drugs through the medical community. So drug usage, because they have fewer people pushing drugs in the communities, and then, of course, if the 12 of us here were taken on the program, we were heavy users, our suppliers would no longer have this market. They'd go off someplace else to other grounds. So as a result, fewer drugs come into the communities, fewer drugs are pushed on our people, and drug usage has gone down. That's a good thing, isn't it? Switzerland thought so. You know what else they found out? The employability, the employment of these people went up by 50%. They were holding jobs, paying their taxes, supporting their children. They were not a drain on society. They were living pretty much productive lives. That was a good thing. And lastly, of course, the health of these people went up drastically. Nobody encountered AIDS. Nobody got hepatitis. Nobody overdosed of unknown quantities of these drugs, etc. They had a plebiscite in Switzerland because some, what I would call moralists, saying, you know, we shouldn't do this for moral reasons. Boy, don't fly on Southwest Airlines, they'll get at you. For moral reasons, they said, no, we shouldn't do this program. You know, they had a plebiscite countrywide in Switzerland to disband this program. That plebiscite failed by more than 70% of the vote. It failed, and they still now made these programs permanent in the country of Switzerland. I can't believe that Swiss parents care less about their children and love their children less than we do. Do you? But they have something that's working. And this is something that, in my view, we should adopt in every city in our country and every community that needs it, that would support it. Can anyone think of any reason at all why we should not do that? And the only reason when I've asked that question is, oh, we're sending the wrong message to our children. That's what I hear, that old, tired, hackneyed, but emotional response. And my response to that is, nonsense. Don't hide these programs from our children. Take them there. Expose our children to these people that are addicted to these drugs. What are the people going to tell them? Oh, yeah, you should jam some cocaine up your nose and really make a mess of your life so you too can be on this program and get your pharmaceutical drugs at cost. Is that what they're going to tell them? Never. Don't do what I've done. It's a hard life. Look at me. I am in trouble medically. This is not something that you should do. You know how I got involved in these drugs? Well, somebody gave me a free sample of methamphetamines or whatever it is. They'll tell their stories. It is good education for our children. It's honest education, and it will take. Same thing with needle exchanges. Oh, we shouldn't have needle exchanges. Here in San Francisco, you're leading the way in that, and hats off to you. It is a no-brainer. In fact, it is a crime on our people to deprive them of needle exchange. All of the studies show, San Francisco here, New Haven, Connecticut, other places, that it does not increase drug usage, but clearly reduces the incidence of AIDS, hepatitis, and these other things. That is an immoral thing, a damnable thing, for us to deprive people of these needles, if in fact they're going to use this stuff anyway. If they are, I don't care what we call them as a society. And I know what I call them. I call them drug-addicted people that have medical problems. But you can call them moral degenerates if you want to. You certainly can call them criminals. They do not deserve to die of AIDS. They do not deserve to pass along AIDS to their loved ones, to their sexual partners, and the rest. And if only for monetary reasons, we as taxpayers don't want that to happen. If that's what it comes to, that's what we'll talk about. So all of these things are out there. We should expose our children to needle exchange programs, too. Let them talk to those people. What are they going to tell them? Oh, yeah, you know, this is fun life. Never. That will not happen. So these are things we need to do. It is a pleasure to be able to be with you. I believe in this so strongly. I hate these drugs passionately. I am a former federal prosecutor, as David said. You know, I held the record for the largest drug prosecution in the Central District of California back in about 1978. 75 kilos of heroin, about 160 pounds. That's a lot of heroin. Does anyone have any idea what the record drug prosecution now is in the Central District of California? 18 tons of cocaine in one transaction. Can you imagine? You know, if we can't keep these drugs out of prison, how in heaven's name do we expect to keep them off the streets of Oakland, San Francisco, or anywhere else? It just isn't going to work. So let's recognize that. And let me leave you with a story, because it's an honor to be able to be on a program with my friend Judge Thon Walker here. It's an honor, by the way. I have friends here. Dr. Bob Lull, I've met from a while back. When I was younger, I was actually running for Congress, and he was helping me, and thank you, Bob, for that. Marcia over here is doing Titan work. If you folks are unfamiliar with the Linda Smith Center, Drug Policy Foundation, you're doing us all a disservice. This is the group, in my opinion, that is able to get the word out as an educational effort to talk openly and honestly in this area. And Marcia is here representing the Linda Smith Center, and it's nice to see you. There are others, too, I can't go into, except for one, and that is my son, Bill. He's over here. I have advertised him that he is here working in the San Francisco area, working for AAA, and he's the one that is keeping them productive. So you owe an awful lot to my son, Bill. He's right here. Stand up, William P. That's a boy. I did him a dirty trick yesterday that maybe some of you know, but I couldn't possibly repeat. But it is a pleasure to be with you. Let me just end this, my discussion here, and then maybe we can get into questions after Judge Walker has a chance at you. And that is that, you know, there was a man on his deathbed, very end of his life, and he knew it. And at the very end, he called his wife into his side and said, "Well, dear, before I leave this earth, I just have to get something off my chest. For a number of years now, I've been having an affair with such and such a woman that lives across the street. And I'm sorry, but I think you had a right to know, and you had to hear it from me." She thought for a moment. Then she said, "That's okay. I know. That's why I poisoned you." in such a similar way, we are poisoning ourselves by the way we have chosen to deal with this very difficult topic. It is an emotional topic. We must treat this as managers and not as moralists. We must understand that harmful as these drugs can be, although they're just things, they also have some very useful properties as well. But sometimes, even with the harm, these drugs are here to stay. So let's recognize that. Let's try to reduce all of the harm that can and will be caused by their presence in our communities. The harm with regard to the misspending of our resources, the harm with regard to the loss of our civil liberties, the loss of our innate ability to do what we want with our body and have our own responsibility for it, and the loss, in fact, the arrogance, the increased arrogance with regard to the federal government supposedly having all of the answers and dictating to us as citizens what will happen. We can do better. We must do better. I guarantee that we will be successful in this. The question is when. I know that it can be done. I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk with you this evening. I look forward to your questions. Thank you all for being here. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Jim.